hours and 39 combat missions. He and his twin brother, both astronauts, have dedicated their lives to our country in the most noble way. Scott Kelly spent almost a year in space to study the effects of long-duration space travel on the human body. Because they are identical twins, retired astronaut Mark, down here on Earth, while Scott was in space, was the perfect control subject. Mark Kelly had also been put to the test by personal tragedy when his wife, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, was shot in the head in an assassination attempt. I had watched as he stood beside her every step of her long, difficult recovery and fought tirelessly for sensible gun reform. We'd worked together on that issue in the Senate. They had both been supportive friends ever since I was AG. Since I was also in charge of overseeing the National Space Council, I'd sought Mark's opinion on how to maintain a thriving aerospace industry for civilian and military ends. He'd advised me on one of my proudest achievements, the Artemis Accords, which provide a forward-looking set of international principles on how humanity uses the resources of space, the moon, and Mars. One of its most immediate concerns is creating a legal framework for how we deal with ever-proliferating space junk as the number of satellites increase and older ones decay and fall to Earth. When I took up my role at the Space Council, only 9 nations had signed on to the accords. After my meetings with Narendra Modi, Emmanuel Macron, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and many other world leaders, it's now 55. Mark and I shared this passionate interest. I was impressed that Mark had won his Senate seat in a traditionally red state, helping to turn it purple. He was pro-business in a way that mattered to me and could be helpful in countering the Republican narrative that I wasn't. As a senator for a border state, he'd broken with our party's preferred language on migration, calling the situation, quote, a crisis. I agreed with that characterization and had argued that the White House should also use that word. Irregular migration was a crisis, a global one, to which we, America, always a beacon for the poor and the threatened, could not be and were not immune. Politically, I rarely emphasize that point because it could be mischaracterized as a lame excuse. But Mark's slowness to sign on to the PRO Act, protecting unions' right to organize, had raised a red flag. He had come out in full-throated support as recently as July 24th, aware, maybe, that I would only choose a running mate who was unquestionably pro-labor. I admired Mark Kelly. He would be magnetic. As I sat across from him, what I saw was our American ideal of selfless service. Untarnished, he also hadn't yet had a, quote, oh shit moment in his relatively short political career. I wasn't sure how he would cope with the kind of garbage Trump would throw at him. Could a captain, used to deference and respect, adapt to an opponent's national campaign, specifically designed to disrespect him, to cut a hero down to something small? John Kerry, a war hero, had been swift-boated, defamed in an untrue campaign about his military record that had unfairly damaged his reputation. The guy who led that effort, Chris LaCivita, was now one of Trump's top campaign aides. I realized I couldn't afford to test Mark Kelly in that ugly grinder. When Kelly left, I got on a Zoom call with the selection committee and my chosen committee of advisors. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, former Congressman Cedric Richmond, and Tony West. We reviewed what we'd heard from each of these exceptional men and weighed the pros and cons. Their concerns were how adeptly and passionately each of them would defend me. In short, who would be most loyal and effective at the job? The ambition must be for the job, not for the political future beyond. To get a young person's opinion, I called my godson, Alexander Hudlin, 17 years old and very much a creature of the zeitgeist. He was for Walls. Auntie, I like him. My senior staff, to a person, strongly favored Tim. A confidential group within the campaign had already mocked up announcements pumping whichever of the three I chose, ready to press send once my decision could be announced. This helped me envision the narrative of our ticket. It was late when I finally sat down in the family room. Maya and Tony were staying with us. They both liked Walls. Maya especially liked the fact that he was not trying to be anything but the best vice president for her sister. "He's loyal. He'll have your back on the trail. And it's clear that you like him," she said. Doug and I went back and forth. He had known Josh longer and leaned that way. It was always going to have to be my decision. I told my staff and family that I didn't want any more input, and I went to do something practical. I made a tasty rub and seasoned a pork roast. By the time I went to bed, I'd decided on Walls. August 5th, 92 days to the election. In the morning, as usual, Doug was up before me. He likes to make his coffee from scratch. I've pointed out to him that there are machines that grind the beans and make the brew so that it's all ready for you when you wake up. But he's not interested. He likes his system. I was standing there in my bathrobe waiting for the noise of the grinder to stop. "Honey," I said, "have I made the right choice?" I hate being indecisive, but there I was. Doug turned and gave me a look. "Your gut is always right. Trust it." I knew very well that wheels were already in motion. Sheila had assembled a small, trusted team who were en route to Minnesota to brief Tim and get the whole family ready for the rally that night. Ink was already flowing onto hundreds of Harris Walls posters. I recalled an earlier conversation with Barack Obama. He'd also narrowed it down to three finalists: Joe Biden, Evan Bayh, and Tim Kaine. I asked him how he'd finally decided on Joe. "I chose Joe because we were very different," he said. "Different types, different sets of experience. You cover more ground." That accorded with my thinking and made me feel good about my decision. While I worked out, I turned on the television to see what the American people were watching. So much political punditry feels to me like high-class gossip, usually based on speculation with minimal facts. That morning's chatter was no exception. It was time to call Tim. I got my campaign videographer ready to film the call for social media. Then I sat down at the table and tapped in his number. It went to voicemail. I called again. Same. Tim, at home in Minnesota, saw a blocked number on his cell phone and figured it was a spam call. He didn't pick up. He didn't want his line to be busy just in case I called. I had to get Sheila to text him and tell him to pick up the damn phone. The cat out of the bag, Gwen, his wife, videoed the call on their end. She caught him sitting down by the window in his camo baseball cap as he finally answered. "Hi, this is Tim." "It's Kamala Harris. Good morning, Governor." "Listen, I want you to do this with me. Let's do this together. Would you be my running mate? And let's get this thing on the road." "I would be honored," he said. My next job was to quickly contact Josh and Mark. The news had already started to leak, and they should hear this from me, not the media. Dana Remus later let me know that Josh had been trying to reach me earlier that morning. The only reason I could imagine for him calling was that he'd intuited he wouldn't be the choice and wanted to withdraw first, so it would be seen as his decision. But nothing was said about that, and he graciously offered to introduce us in Philly. I'd been concerned that holding the rally there as long planned would seem disrespectful to him, since so many had expected and wanted him to be my choice. But he dismissed those concerns and said he knew such a major event could not be relocated at the last minute, even if he had wanted me to, which he did not. It would, he said, be a great opportunity to show party unity around the newly decided ticket. I appreciated his leadership. Mark Kelly was equally gracious, promising that I had his support and that he and Gabby would do everything they possibly could. He lived up to that promise throughout the rest of the campaign. Of course, the world had not conveniently paused as I managed the vice presidential process. The White House sits at the center of a hailstorm of events, national and global, and that barrage does not stop for an election. As I'd been interviewing and making my decision, I was acutely aware of the rising tensions between Iran and Israel. That afternoon, I headed to the Situation Room, where the president had convened a meeting of the national security team. My first duty as vice president was to be there to help assess the intelligence and advice, and to offer the room and the president my perspective. I'm only the 11th sitting vice president to run for president. When speaking on the campaign trail or facing Trump on the debate stage, the gravity of moments in the Situation Room weighed heavily on my heart and mind. I will never discuss, here or anywhere else, the conversations in that room, the middle-of-the-night calls to gather there, the dramas that unfolded. Unlike the current national security team, we did not hash out our plans on Signal. America's national security relies heavily on classified information that our adversaries try very hard to acquire. Why make it easy for them? And where is the professionalism? Where is the self-discipline? As soon as I became vice president, I disabled my text capability and even the camera on my phone. For 4 years, I did not receive or send a text message of any kind, official or unofficial. As for matters of national security, whatever the hour or the day of the week, the president and I and our entire team hauled our asses out of bed and into a SCIF, a sensitive, compartmented information facility, or the Situation Room. Sometimes in the middle of dinner or watching a show, I would receive a certain call and immediately get up and leave the room. Doug would say, "There she goes again," aware that he'd never know from me what crisis had interrupted us. Our task that afternoon was to assess current intelligence and make sure we were doing everything we could to calm tensions. Back in April, Iran had launched more than 100 ballistic missiles at Israel. It could have led to an uncontrollable escalation. It hadn't, thanks to intense diplomatic efforts by our administration. We and our regional allies had rallied to Israel's defense and limited the damage. We have not had diplomats or a CIA station in Iran for almost a half century, since students occupied our embassy and took our people hostage in 1979. We know the threat posed by the regime of the Ayatollahs, but the United States has not always aligned with our Israeli allies on how best to contain it. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal, painstakingly brokered by the Obama administration, had paused Tehran's march to the bomb and given us the ability to see into Iran's nuclear program through regular International Atomic Energy Agency inspections. Netanyahu had encouraged Trump to tear up the plan, which he did in 2018, shutting down that ability and unshackling Tehran. Differences of opinion existed, even within our national security team. As with every national security issue, the president would hear from the generals. He would challenge the heads of the intelligence community. He would seek a global view, teasing out how any given action we might take in one region would be perceived by our allies or our adversaries elsewhere. His years of experience in foreign policy clearly showed in those discussions. He was always focused, always Commander-in-Chief, in that room. My job was to sit at his right hand, hear all views, test assumptions, ask hard questions, and help him make the best decisions he could. August 6th, 91 days to the election. I hadn't met Tim's family. From the vetting file, I knew that his wife, Gwen, had been a teacher for 2 decades, and that she and Tim had met when their underfunded public school in Nebraska had to install a flimsy partition dividing one classroom into two. She taught on one side, Tim on the other. I also knew that she'd championed criminal justice reform and stressed the role of educational opportunity in diverting youth from crime. I knew we'd be closely aligned on these issues. While she was known as an important advisor to her husband, she hadn't taken a high-profile public role as Minnesota's First Lady. I wondered how she'd manage the glare of the next 91 days. It didn't take long to find out. Gwen got right in there and proved to be a force. As wife of a 2-term governor and a guy who'd held congressional leadership positions, she was no neophyte on the trail, exuding warmth, heart, and soul. A campaign like ours is something you do as 2 couples, 2 families, 2 partnerships, combining to form a 3rd. It forges intimacy and brings you close. I adore Gwen. Our first encounter was in the locker room of the Temple University gym, appropriate enough for Coach Walls. It was my idea for the campaign to lean into Tim's brand as coach, a role that conveys both strength and caring. Tim was a relative unknown nationally, but there was so much about him that would be familiar to people's everyday relationships and experiences. Not many people have met an astronaut, and they might not love politicians, but most people can relate to a high school coach. And with early voting starting in 45 days, that immediate connection was important. Knowing that, I'd asked the team to print up coach signs that people could hold up at rallies. Their kids, Hope and Gus, understandably seemed a little shell-shocked by the sudden change in their young lives. Doug and I understood what they were going through. Our kids had been there 4 years before. I sent the staff away. We wanted to have a moment where we were just 2 families getting acquainted. I was concerned for the kids and wanted them to know this was going to be okay and that we cared about them as people, not just props to walk on stage with. We pulled chairs into a circle and chatted, getting to know one another a little before it was time to go. As we stood, Tim gathered us in a huddle like we were his team in the locker room about to run onto the field. We put our hands in the circle and raised them with a cheer. 10,000 people had gathered to hear from us. The roar that met us when we walked out on stage was so deafening we could barely hear ourselves. Tim, unused to crowds of that size, looked astonished. My first job that night was to introduce Tim Walls to the country. This was not hard. The man has a biography that could provide scripts for several Hallmark movies. I led with how he'd coached a perennially losing high school football team. They hadn't scored a single touchdown in the first 6 weeks of the season before he became coach, to winning the state championship. I went on to tell the story of how a student who wanted to start the first gay-straight alliance at the school had gone to this storied football coach to ask for his support. Walls immediately agreed to become the group's faculty advisor. Tim said he thought it would send a message of inclusion if the advisor was a football coach, a soldier, straight, and married. Waiting in the wings with Doug, Gwen was visibly nervous. When it came time for them to join us, Doug said, "Follow me," and swept her out onto the stage. As the four of us stood for applause, Tim grabbed Doug, rather than Gwen, for the big hug. Cole and Tony later joked that Doug had never hugged them as passionately as he hugged Tim that night. When Tim clasped my hand to thrust it high in an enthusiastic victory gesture, he was so tall that the entire front of my jacket rose up. It felt like I was dangling from a jungle gym while wearing a suit. Not the best look. I made a mental note to tell him, "From now on, when we do that, you gotta bend your elbow." We rode the high of the crowd that night. It was a room full of joy. The campaign was fresh, alive, vibrating with energy. It seemed like anything was possible. August 7th, 90 days to the election. It was a perfect summer day in Wisconsin. Red barns against a rinsed blue sky, emerald fields ripe with the promise of a good harvest. I lived in Wisconsin for a while when I was a preschooler, and my parents had teaching jobs there. The beauty of the state on days like this brings back strong childhood memories. I'd left a muggy, overcast Washington, D.C. for my first full day on the trail with Tim. When I boarded Air Force Two, I checked in with my team in the front cabin. Sheila and my dedicated Deputy Chief of Staff, Aaron Wilson, were among those staffing me that day. Then I headed back through the cabin containing my Secret Service detail for a few minutes of off-the-record chat, or OTR, with the traveling press. These informal sessions before Wheels Up were useful for both of us. They got to ask me anything. And as the different reporters who joined us covered diverse beats, the topics could be wide-ranging. My responses were candid and would often inform the on-record questions they would ask me later. For my part, I got a preview of the issues that might shape the day's news cycle. Pool reporters work hard, fast, and selflessly. Since not every reporter can fit on the plane or in the West Wing, representatives of each media organization rotate the responsibility for being with me or the president and send out the first quick drafts of what is going on for the use of all their colleagues. They are on duty whenever we are engaged in public events, and in a campaign, that can be a long day's work. Pool reports generally start with the words "pool swept," meaning they and their belongings have been checked by security. And in their words, loading, rolling at some ungodly hour. They generally end late at night with the word "lid." This indicates there will be no more news that day, although not because I've finally gone to bed. My day continues with briefings, prep, sometimes radio interviews, live or recorded. My personal lid often doesn't go on until the very early hours. On the way back from the OTR with the press pool to my cabin up front, I had a cherished ritual. I always high-fived the head of my Secret Service detail, who would stand as I walked by. "Max," I'd exclaim as our hands met in the air. "Ma'am," he'd crisply reply. The Secret Service assigns code names to its protectees. Mine, aptly, was Pioneer. Doug's, Playmaker. The kids, who also had Secret Service protection, were allowed to choose their own names so long as they started with P. Ella, with her quirky sense of humor, chose Pickle. Cole became Pirate. We landed at Chippewa Valley Regional Airport to be greeted by local officials and Girl Scout Troop 3307. I asked the girls about their summer plans, and one asked about mine. I said I was planning on going somewhere in 90 days, and we shared a laugh. I got into my motorcade, but we weren't pulling out. I asked Max, why weren't we leaving? That was when I learned we were being held up by J.D. Vance. He was out of his car and walking toward Air Force Two, in violation of every rule of security and protocol. I later learned that he told reporters he was there because, quote, I just wanted to check out my future plane. Had I known he was pulling that juvenile stunt, I would have been inclined to step from my car and use a word I believe best pronounced correctly. It begins with an M and ends with a. By now, I suppose he will be well acquainted with that old plane. It came into service for Al Gore in 1998. It's hard to replace, since Boeing no longer makes a jet as compact yet high-powered, able to take off and land at smaller airports like Chippewa Valley Regional. Vance will have learned that the vice president's seat resists adjustment when you want to move it, but flies unexpectedly forward at inopportune moments. He'll know that the door to the restroom doesn't always stay closed or may not even open. Wrestling with that door as we were trying to fix America's infrastructure problems, I knew this was one infrastructure problem I would not be able to fix. When press would cover me hustling up the stairs to board, it wasn't because I relished the luxury of that plane. It was the thought of the comfy Uggs I kept on board when I could finally kick off my high heels. It is probably just as well that I didn't know about Vance's sophomoric comment that day, since I was already annoyed. As Maya Angelou famously said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. He had dared to accuse Tim Walz of, quote, stolen valor, a grievous smear pieced together from the most threadbare scraps. Walz entered the National Guard at 17 and served for 24 years, including an overseas deployment to Italy. He could have retired after 20 years, but re-upped after 9/11 and continued to serve until deciding to run for Congress in May of 2005, flipping a solidly red seat. His unit was notified of a deployment 2 months after his retirement and actually deployed a full 8 months after that. Vance picked on Tim's statement when arguing for an assault weapons ban in 2018 that, quote, these weapons of war that I carried in war had no place on civilian streets. Walz hadn't seen combat during his deployments. Neither had Vance, who served 4 years as reporter in the Marines' Public Affairs Department. But that didn't stop him from spinning Tim's minor misstatement into a swift boat-style slander. He also implied that Tim's retirement had been timed to avoid the Iraq deployment, even though it had been entirely driven by the timing of his run for Congress. These attacks went against everything I knew and admired about the military code of honor. I was appalled that Vance would stoop so low to wound and rattle a fellow veteran, a better man. Our motorcade turned down a dusty road toward a vast field, colorful, with 12,000 people and resonant with the strains of the band Bon Iver finishing a live set. Some people had abandoned their cars a mile from the field and walked the rest of the way. Many held their blue Harris Wall signs over their heads for protection from the brilliant sunshine. A local farmer introduced Tim as a lifelong Midwesterner who understands rural America. Tim proved it as he spoke, connecting to the enthusiastic crowd and finding a Midwestern cadence in which to talk about reproductive rights, LGBTQ+ issues, and how Trump's Republicans infringed on basic freedoms. Even if we wouldn't make the same choices for ourselves, there's a golden rule. Mind your own damn business, he said. I don't need you telling me about our health care. I don't need you telling us who we love. And I sure the hell don't need you telling us what books we're going to read. Then he took a sly swipe at J.D. Vance, who was over at an aviation equipment manufacturer in nearby Eau Claire, busy lying about Tim's record. Just like all of us in regular America, we go to Yale and then we have our careers funded by Silicon Valley billionaires. And then you write a book about the place you grew up and you trash that place. We're better than that, Tim said. When I took the podium after Tim, the crowd was in high spirits. As I talked about Trump, a chant started. Lock him up. I disliked that chant. When Trump aimed it at Hillary, and I wasn't about to encourage it at my rallies. In the democracy I cherish, we don't lock people up because they are our political opponents. They are locked up if a jury determines they have committed serious crimes. As a former prosecutor, I know what it means to ask that someone be locked up. I know the seriousness of depriving someone of their liberty. It is not something I have ever taken lightly. I carried the moral weight of it. I would never reduce it to a chant to please and entertain a crowd. I held up my hand and interrupted the chants. Well, hold on. You know what? The courts are going to handle that part of it. What we're going to do is beat them in November. That evening, we held an even bigger rally in a large airport hangar at Wayne County Airport near Detroit. The crowd spilled out of the hangar and across the tarmac where Air Force Two had landed. There were several giant screens for the outdoor crowd that couldn't see the rally stage. The size of the crowd unnerved Donald Trump. He would later post on Truth Social that, quote, nobody had been there and the crowd pictures were fake. He was getting rattled. Supporters gleefully posted their own photos from the rally. Lavora Barnes, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, playfully posted a photo of herself addressing the crowd from the podium and thanked, quote, whoever made the AI image for being kind enough to include me at the lectern. That AI crowd was really loud, she wrote. My ears just stopped ringing from their imaginary cheering. David Plouffe's post on X was less tongue-in-cheek. These are not conspiratorial rantings from the deepest recesses of the internet. The author could have the nuclear codes and be responsible for decisions that will affect us all for decades. August 8th, 89 days to the election. Sean Fain, president of the United Auto Workers, has union in his DNA. His grandparents came up from the South to work in Indiana car plants, two at GM, one at Chrysler. He was hired at Chrysler in 1994, just in time to watch UAW courage evaporate and corruption take hold as auto jobs moved to non-union plants that they'd failed to organize or out of the country entirely. As president, he led an audacious series of strikes that won workers more than 25% pay increases. He sometimes wears a pin commemorating his take-no-prisoners approach to those acrimonious contract talks. It's a disc with a tiny spinning arrow, reading, fuck. The arrow points variously to words on the pin's rim, this, off, and you. I stood on the picket line with UAW workers during the strikes, and I admired the way Fain's leadership had revived the union. Tim and I met with him and 170 union members at Local 900 Hall in Wayne, Michigan. Fain said the union had endorsed me because, quote, Kamala is one of us, Tim Walz is one of us. And he talked about the, quote, Trump-Vance disaster. Members in the hall interjected the words felon, racist, scab. He asked the members to show up for us in the campaign, putting into action the organizing capacity that has always made unions integral to Democrats' electoral success. When Tim spoke, he underlined that message. 89 days, we can do anything for 89 days. Tell people, sleep when you're dead. You've got work to do. August 9th, 88 days to the election. Trump had been sitting on his gilded furniture at home in Mar-a-Lago for a week, letting me dominate the news cycle. Perhaps realizing this and worried for his candidacy, he'd finally agreed to debate me on September 10th and suggested that two more debates should follow. I said I'd be glad to discuss terms for those. As Tim and I barnstormed Arizona, meeting with small business owners at a Latino-owned restaurant and talking about border security, Trump headed to solidly red Montana for the purpose of undermining the principled Democratic Senator John Tester, whom he had campaigned against and failed to unseat in the previous election cycle. It was at his rally in Bozeman that he once again pretended he didn't know how to pronounce my name. Kamala, sometimes referred to as Carmela, you know, she's got about 9 different ways of pronouncing the name. And because the press is so dishonest, no matter how you say it, they'll say you were wrong. You were wrong. I don't care if I get it right. Actually, I couldn't care less. Unquote. He was playing up the disrespect, but the secondary intent was to reinforce the notion that I was alien, other, too different to lead America. He lied and said I'd refused to debate him when he'd been the one throwing up obstacles and then said I'd refused to do a press interview. Quote, you know why? 'Cause she's dumb. I read the volley of insults as a signal that he was unnerved by the crowds I was drawing and the continuing flood of funds into our campaign. Comments to reporters that day by Montana Senator Steve Daines, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, seemed to confirm that. There's definitely a honeymoon period going on, he said, of the enthusiasm for my candidacy. He predicted it would continue through the Democratic National Convention, and the mood would change by mid-September. It turned out to be more complicated than that, and he was off on the timing. But he wasn't entirely wrong. August 10th, 87 days to the election. There had been hecklers at the rally in Phoenix the night before, and once again, I'd addressed them directly. I'd been talking about healthcare as a human right when a small group of Gaza protesters interrupted. Okay, guys, I said, let's talk Gaza for a moment. We all want this war to end and to get the hostages out, and I will work on it full time when I am president, as I have been. That morning, we woke to news of an Israeli strike that had killed at least 80 people in Gaza. As I left the hotel, I took questions from the press in the parking lot, underlining yet again that even though Israel had every right to go after Hamas, far too many civilians were being killed, and that Israel had a responsibility to avoid these deaths. It was a blisteringly hot afternoon in Phoenix, and when we arrived in Las Vegas a little before 4 p.m., it was even hotter, 109 degrees. Since I joined the race, volunteer numbers in Nevada had surged 400%, thanks in large part to the organizing work of Megan Jones. She came to me 5 years earlier, schooled in the Harry Reid style of politics, and like him, she knew how to throw a punch on behalf of people who needed defending. There was a long line of supporters still waiting to get through the magnetometers into the university arena where we'd hold the rally. I was concerned for so many people standing outside in that extreme weather, especially when I heard ambulance sirens. People were collapsing from heat stroke. Local officials wisely made the call to close the doors to avoid more casualties. 4,000 people were turned away. On that occasion, the officials made the right humane call. But there were other times, other venues, where my deputy chief of staff, Aaron, had to argue with fire marshals who wanted to shut the doors and turn crowds away long before the posted safe capacity had been reached. Sometimes this happened when the lines were still long and whole sections of seating had yet to be filled. It was political gamesmanship, pure and simple. I was lucky to have a tough-minded team to push back against it, but they did not always prevail. So many people stand behind a candidate doing unglamorous, indispensable work. Juan Ortega oversaw my advance team, the people who wrangle venues, hotels, drop-in visits, liaising with local communities, smoothing over all kinds of problems. One person I saw almost every day was Alexa Lewis. She was there in the wings at every rally. I would walk from the venue's green room to a designated spot backstage, where if there was a monitor, I could watch the remarks of the person introducing me. Then I would move to the wings at the side of the stage. It would be just me, Alexa, and the Secret Service. Alexa would stand, her right hand held out in a stop sign, and I would wait obediently behind her. Freedom would play, and at the exactly right moment, Alexa would turn her hand over in a go-ahead gesture, and I would head for the stage. She was my human traffic light. To the 12,000 who had made it inside at that Las Vegas rally, I expressed gratitude to the Culinary Workers Union, which had endorsed us, and I promised to work to increase the minimum wage. The CWU's members are mostly women, mostly immigrants. They prepare the food, make the beds, clean the rooms, do the invisible work that allows visitors to have a great time. They are the people you don't see, hardworking, unsung, underpaid. The culinary workers had asked in earlier discussions that we eliminate tax on tips, and my policy team had been working on our proposal before Trump's half-baked announcement. I'd much rather give a tax cut to low-wage service workers than to billionaires. But unlike Trump, I worked to pair the exemption idea with an increase in the minimum wage. Because the sad fact is that most tipped workers are so underpaid that they don't earn enough to owe any federal taxes. For those people, eliminating the tax on their tips would be meaningless. I stressed that the exemption would be crafted to ensure affluent professionals didn't start restructuring their compensation to take advantage of the loophole. Las Vegas was the last stop on this swing state tour. Air Force Two was headed next to San Francisco, where my political career began. August 11th, 86 days to the election. One reason I'd come home to the Bay Area was to address nearly 700 key supporters who together just that evening had raised over $12 million for my campaign. There were many long-standing friends there, but two of the faces I was happiest to see were Amara's and Leela's. They dashed into my arms and I hugged and loved them up. It had only been a couple of weeks since I'd waved goodbye to them from my helicopter, but so much had happened. When Nancy Pelosi, vivid in a fuchsia pantsuit, walked on stage to introduce me, the audience stood in applause. She had been the most skilled House Speaker since Tip O'Neill. Branded a San Francisco liberal, her opponents soon learned that she was genetically a Baltimore girl. Steely, pragmatic, and resilient. Everyone in that room believed she'd been a factor in changing the fate of this campaign. In her pointed public statements and in private, she'd brought some realism to Joe and his inner circle, forcing them to confront the dwindling money and tanking polls. When I ran for San Francisco District Attorney in 2003, Nancy had supported the incumbent I was running against. When I won, she praised my strategy. She had been blunt about preferring a mini primary after Joe stepped down, but she'd quickly offered her full support to me once she realized I had the numbers and the vocal support of so many other party leaders. Before my speech, I had a meet and greet with some high-level donors. I pulled aside one of the most long-standing and generous, a leader in Silicon Valley. My head close to his ear, I said, "I'm concerned about Musk. Are you guys on top of it?" I wanted reassurance that the tech people who supported democracy were putting resources into combating mis and disinformation. We needed a counterforce to whatever might be brewing, and I knew the campaign I'd inherited didn't have the skill set or the resources for it. The people I knew in Silicon Valley had a much better grasp of how deep the roots went, how far they spread. Elon Musk had set off my spidey senses long before his magification and his endorsement of Trump. Both SpaceX and Tesla sprang to life in California, and millions of California taxpayers had helped the companies prosper. But when Democrats tried to tie electric car subsidies to workplace standards, Tesla had been sued for labor violations, including racial discrimination and suppressing union organizing efforts. Musk began a rightward pivot. It accelerated during COVID when he refused to close the Tesla plant to protect the health of his workers. When he moved his operations to Texas, he claimed it was because the state offered more, quote, freedom, which was the height of hypocrisy, since Texas, with its draconian abortion ban and the privacy-shredding policies around it, violated the most basic of human liberties. Musk is a talented entrepreneur, but there are genius engineers behind the cars and rockets, such as Tesla's former longtime chief technical officer, J.B. Straubel, who deserve just as much credit. Despite what I think of Musk, I believe Joe Biden made a mistake in not inviting him to the White House in 2021 for an event promoting our electric vehicle policy. I shared this view with his team. Behind the president on the lawn that day were electric Fords, Chevys, Jeeps, American-made Teslas, then the world's most innovative and successful electric cars, were nowhere to be seen. Biden, loyal to the UAW, was sending a message about Musk's anti-union stance. But as president of the United States, if you are convening the nation's manufacturers of electric vehicles, and the biggest player in the field is not there, it simply doesn't make sense. Musk never forgave it. Since he had acquired Twitter and sacked its content moderators and fact-checkers, the platform had become a den of conspiracy theories and alt-right bile. It was also, increasingly, Musk's personal megaphone for boosting Trump and denigrating me. Musk had announced that he would interview Trump live on X the next evening. He would deliver Trump the opportunity to spew his lies free of fact-checking. And in the days that followed, he would deliver a whole lot more. August 12th, 85 days to the election. This space is not available. That was the message in the dead air of what was supposed to be the live stream between Trump and Musk. The conversation, due to start at 8 p.m., finally kicked off at 8:42 p.m. Musk couldn't even run a live stream in the year 2024. What followed eventually was the usual litany of insults and lies, at least 20 false claims, according to CNN fact-checkers, as the two edgelords stroked each other's egos. I thought back to meetings I'd convened with other business leaders and CEOs when we were advocating our Build Back Better agenda. People who had shown that you can build great companies while taking care of your workforce and the planet. Among them were Hamdi Ulukaya of Chobani, Allison Reitenauer of Seventh Generation, Jenna Johnson of Patagonia, and Josh Silverman of Etsy. All the leaders I'd invited ran highly successful businesses that also supported childcare and/or paid leave policies for their employees. We would discuss how our agenda would support childcare and therefore help the corporate bottom line. When families don't have reliable quality care for their kids, it increases absenteeism, lowers productivity, and leads to higher turnover. The estimated losses to earnings and revenues are $57 billion a year. These younger leaders in the corporate world understood that paid leave gave a good return on investment, It was not only the right thing to do, but it made economic sense. It's a win-win for workers and the companies. People work more productively and without distraction if they know their kids are well cared for. Our goal in the Build Back Better legislation was to ensure that no parent who wants to work or who has to work would end up paying more than 7% of their income on child care. The Republicans, of course, mischaracterized these provisions in the legislation. They call it socialism. I call it capitalism and a great return on investment. August 19th, 78 days to the election. The convention, day one. It was supposed to have been Joe Biden's convention. COVID had robbed him of a big celebration when he won the nomination in 2020. And now, I suppose, a part of him felt robbed again. The long signs, prepared for the crowd to wave during his climactic speech that night, inadvertently told the whole story. "We love Joe," they read, and in small print, "paid for by Harris for president." I was sensitive to how he and his family must be feeling. It was not the end any of them had wanted for his 50 years of public service. But I was also extremely proud of what we had accomplished in 4 years. This convention would have the big emotional beats, the important speeches, but it would also be fun. We'd put thought into engaging young delegates. There was a special area set up for social media influencers, and DJ Cassidy was going to turn the sometimes tedious roll call into a nationwide dance party, spinning music organic to each state. I love our conventions. I love running into delegates from Alaska and American Samoa and Mississippi and Maine, Americans united by a passion for democracy. I love that at this huge event, the jumbotrons, TV cameras, lights, speakers, there's a real intimacy in the hall. Local organizers and political icons rubbing shoulders, elected leaders and grassroots activists and big donors thrown together for an intense 4 days. At my very first convention in Los Angeles in 2000, I'd been a committed young Dem who hadn't yet run for anything. My bestie Chrisette, who later introduced me to Doug, attended with me, sitting high up in the rafters, cheering for Al Gore. 12 years later, as California Attorney General, I had my first speaking role. It didn't go to plan. The convention that year was held in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was co-chair of the Rules Committee with Martin O'Malley, then the governor of Maryland. The city had rushed to get ready for the incoming hordes. It didn't quite succeed. Parts of the hotel booked for our California delegation remained under construction, with the manufacturer's stickers still on the elevators and no hot water in the showers. When I spoke at the delegates' breakfast, I led with a line from the Eagles song, "Welcome to the Hotel California." I was supposed to give a report on the Rules Committee meeting and then 2 nights later a speech on my work as AG, taking on the big banks. When I rehearsed, the convention director had sage advice. "Walk out there like you bought that podium. You own it. It's your podium." I was trying for that confident strut, head up, shoulders back, when my stiletto sank right through the floor. It had found the trap door in the stage. "If anything goes wrong with the prompter," I'd been instructed, "don't worry. There's a copy of your speech on the shelf of the podium." It was the opening of the convention. The arena was filled with delegates for the very first committee report. As I looked up at the screen where I expected to see the text of my Rules Committee remarks scrolling, I realized that they'd loaded instead my speech for 2 nights later. As I improvised, "We had a great meeting of the Rules Committee. We talked about the rules." My hand was groping for the promised paper speech on the podium shelf. It wasn't there. No matter how many speeches I've made since then, the memory of that teleprompter fail has always been at the back of my mind. I knew it would be with me, even as I walked out, to accept the nomination. Of all the conventions I've attended, this was the most united in years. There'd often been undercurrents, not quite mended rifts. Hillary supporters, sour that she'd been run over by Barack. Bernie supporters, resentful of Hillary's win. It was hard to detect anything but relief in this hall. We could have been staring down a very different 4 days. It could have been a contested convention, a messy floor fight. Instead, there was gratitude that Biden had passed the torch to me. Relief that I'd been able to grasp it. A sense of unity and enthusiasm. Delegates wore T-shirts, some homemade, with a range of slogans. A simple comma, L.A., was popular. A playful instruction on how to pronounce my first name. Kamala is brat, a Charlie XCX reference, abounded. Say it to my face, quoting my debate challenge to Trump, and Chucks and Pearls, referencing my habit of pairing Converse sneakers with my favorite pearl necklace, were also abundant. I appreciated a shirt that read, "Voting is my black job." A delegate and dear friend from San Francisco, Matthew J. Rothschild, proved to be a favorite with press photographers, sporting a boater hat, bedazzled with sprays of glittery stars, red, white, and blue ribbons, and a Kamala doll head. It's not tradition for the nominee to speak on the first night, but I planned to make a surprise appearance, to welcome everybody, and to praise our incredible president. Backstage, I met up with two of the most important people from my childhood. They would speak that night, following a short biographical video about me. Stacy Johnson Batiste was my best friend in kindergarten and remains one of my closest confidants. Her mom, Doris Johnson, and my mother were dear friends. I remember them laughing. They would always cut up together. When she looked at me, held my hand, and said, "Your mother would be so proud of you," I knew she was standing in for my mother, and I could feel my throat constrict. But I would not let myself cry. I told myself, I will not do that tonight. After I went on stage for my brief remarks, I joined the audience to sit next to Doug and Tim. I'm not sure when I started to worry, but at some point, I realized that things were running behind. I knew the program. I knew what we had to get through. If they didn't pick up the pace, I feared that Joe's speech might get pushed right to the edge or even out of prime time in the East. I wanted Joe to have his moment. I couldn't figure out what was up. None of the speeches seemed to be running noticeably over time, although I did observe that Sean Fain, sporting a Trump is a scab T-shirt, finished his timed remarks, which had been loaded in the teleprompter, and then continued his rousing defense of unions from additional notes he'd somehow smuggled onto the podium. And while the introduction said Senator Raphael Warnock, the person who actually walked onto the stage was Reverend Warnock, the head preacher at Ebenezer Baptist Church. Needless to say, he was not brief. I later learned that Biden's people were backstage, reaming out anyone and everyone. Parts of the program were untouchable. Jill Biden had to speak. Then their daughter, Ashley, would introduce Joe. To gain back time, something would have to be cut. In the end, a performance by James Taylor and a video about Joe that Steven Spielberg worked on were regretfully sacrificed. He was supposed to go on at 9:44 p.m., even with those program cuts, when Joe walked on stage to an almost 5-minute audience chant of "Thank you, Joe," it was 11:30 Eastern time. He spoke for nearly an hour, detailing the accomplishments of our administration. It was a legacy speech for him, not an argument for me, and he was entitled to it. But if we waited for some personal stories about working with me and what qualities he had seen that led him to endorse me, they weren't there. and then at last, a fulsome, generous endorsement. Selecting Kamala as my vice president was the very first decision I made when I became our nominee, and it was the best decision I made in my whole career. Given that his career spanned half a century, that was saying something. August 20th, 77 days to the election. The convention, day two. Tim and I left the convention that day to get back on the campaign trail. We couldn't afford 4 days out of the battleground states, but the only night they could spare me was the night of Doug's speech, which made me unhappy. Milwaukee was the closest battleground city, and it was the same stadium where the Republicans held their convention the previous month and where Democrats would have convened but for COVID in 2020. In a perfectly timed and choreographed piece of stagecraft, the convention producers pulled off a live feed between the rally and the convention. I walked out on stage in Milwaukee just as the roll call concluded in Chicago with my California delegation giving me their votes. The roll call is alphabetical, other than the nominee's home state, which is given the honor of being last. On the big screens in the Milwaukee Stadium, I recognized all the beaming faces of the California delegates bunched around the microphone. There were people who had been with me my whole career, some who had worked on my very first campaign, stuffing envelopes under my mother's guidance. It was an emotional moment for me, and it was wonderful to be able to thank those delegates and share the high excitement of the convention with the Wisconsin audience. Flying back to the convention, we watched live on my iPad as Doug gave his speech. We were about to land as Doug wrapped up. The cabin erupted. Doug, Doug, Doug. I was so proud of him. Before I became top of the ticket, Doug expected to have a minor role at the convention, a couple of minutes tucked in someplace. He was suddenly moved way up the roster. "You're going Tuesday," he was told. "Oh, okay. Who am I on with?" he asked. "Barack and Michelle. You three are the primetime package." No pressure. He'd worked hard, writing and practicing the speech. "The words are good, I just have to do it justice, delivering it for her," he told Cole and Ella. He had written it with three main points. "I want people to know she's a badass, that she spent her whole career working for the people, and I want them to know that she gives a shit." He phrased it a little bit more delicately in the speech. Other family members, including Ella, Mina, and my goddaughter Helena Hudlin, also took to the stage to reminisce about my role in their lives. The way the kids stepped up into these highly public roles with grace and aplomb made me so proud. My baby nieces stole the show with their tutorial on how to pronounce my name. Comma, like a comma in a sentence, then la, like la la la. Our creative Cole had directed and narrated a funny and touching video that ran before Doug spoke. It had family pictures of Doug in his very 70s, oversized bow tie at his bar mitzvah, and as an athletic hunk at summer camp. It had his official Employee of the Month photo for McDonald's, and the photo of him wearing that ferocious expression as he grabbed the guy who rushed the stage at my event years earlier. The video dealt frankly with the sadness of the divorce from Kirsten and told the story of how we met and the family we'd all built together. Then Doug's speech described to the world who I was to him, in our family, and as he witnessed my work in the vice president's office. It was an eloquent narrative and a bracing refutation of the ways I had been mischaracterized. Doug's an excellent trial lawyer. He knows how to keep his cool under pressure. No one wants a lawyer who is nervous in front of an audience. But stepping out onto that huge stage, facing a forest of Doug signs, was a whole other level. He took a breath, centered himself, and started his speech with a shout out to my big, beautiful, blended family up there. Kirsten was sitting with Cole and Ella, Doug's parents, his brother, sister, and our niece and nephew, Arden and Jasper. And a special shout out to my mother, mimicking her Brooklyn accent. The only person in the world who thinks Kamala is the lucky one for marrying me. It was a speech full of humor, love, and passionate conviction. Dougie had nailed it. August 21st, 76 days to the election. The convention, day 3. Oprah Winfrey was a surprise speaker at the convention. She hadn't been listed on the program and had snuck into the auditorium in a hat, glasses, and a face mask. In her rousing speech, she listed all the many places in America where she had lived. But it was obvious from the cheers as she took the podium that Chicago claimed her as their own. She did her usual magic, spinning history into a unifying story of optimism and inclusion. And she did it in under 15 minutes. I was delighted to see her on stage that night. But I must admit, there was one prior occasion in the spring of 2017 when I was even